Welcome to our podcast. This is Friends on Fire.
I'm Mike. I'm a lifelong devotee of financial independence. I even wrote a book about it.
And I'm Maggie, a newer convert, but just as passionate, especially on the intersection of minimalism and financial independence. We're one and the
same. We are two like-minded friends who believe that talking about money with your friends and family opens the door to financial well-being.
The Friends on Fire podcast is about dispelling myths, building financial acumen, and sharing your financial independence journey with the people you care about.
This is Friends on Fire. Hey, Maggie.
Hey, Mike.
How's it going?
It's going okay. This has been a doozy of a financial news week.
Yeah, it has, interestingly so. And I don't think people know if they should feel like concerned or very concerned or not concerned at all.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say there might be some people that aren't even really following what's happening.
Oh, I'm sure of it.
And, you know, so I'm sure there's just a mix of people. And a lot of times when things like this are happening, I question the necessity to cover it on the podcast, if that makes sense, because there's a lot of kind of smaller blips in the, you know, the market's constantly up and down. Like, we can't talk about it every week, right? But this has become a big enough moment, and there's just even learning lesson. It's a good learning lesson, might not be the right reference, but this has become a big enough thing that I think it is worth talking about and people better understanding what's happening, because it's not actually that complicated. And, you know, just understanding like what's happening, why is it happening? Does it, you know, it has some rumblings of 2008 and the financial crisis back, the housing crisis back then. And then, you know, like, what does it mean for them? And should we do anything differently?
So our topic today is the SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, collapse. Happened last week. So we were recording this on the 16th. And we had recorded our two episodes about toxic career progression prior to this happening. And we were planning on airing this part two next Monday. But this is timely enough and important enough that we thought we'd jump in and provide some thoughts on it. This is the only thing people have been asking me about this week. And I you know, I get questions a lot from people, especially when I'm around the office. But I must have had 10 people come up to me yesterday, Wednesday, and ask me how I felt about this and whether or not they should be concerned. So I think it's confusing, but also a little scary.
We will get back to part two of toxic career pressure next week. But gosh, if we want to connect these topics, there has got to be some toxic career pressure working for these banks.
Yeah, no kidding.
Big banks. Good point. Banks especially. But anyway, that was a very loose attempt to mix this mashup all together.
All right. So let's talk about what happened. So on Friday the 10th, the FDIC announced that they were going to take over a bank that had collapsed, SVB, out in California. And it was the largest bank collapse since 2008. Now, it's sort of easy to understand what a bank collapse is, but I think it's written about in such a way that makes it a little more confusing. So let me give a very simple description of it. You know, banks take deposits and then they go make investments. So they don't have a lot of money on hand. They certainly don't have money like in their branches, but they don't have a lot of money on hand because those deposits are sitting in investments and they are locked up for certain time periods. And so SVB had something like $175, $200 billion of deposits that they had invested. They had invested it. Those investments lost value. And when people wanted their money back, the bank could not provide all of those withdrawals. And that means it collapses. And the collapse is something that the government determines and then takes over.
Mike, I think this is worth repeating for people because I don't know that the average person understands how a bank makes money, right? Banks are a part of our lives. They're there. But I just think it's worth kind of repeating what you just said. And I'll repeat it in Maggie terms because it's sometimes a little bit different than Mike terms.
Sure.
Like, I'm going to really like make this basic for people. Like, banks make money in two core ways, from loans, like mortgage loans, for example, but also SVB had a lot of loans to large, tech startups in the Silicon Valley area. And then in addition to loans, they make money from investments. And to clarify, investments is what you were just talking about. And that is literally when I deposit as a you know, member of that bank, I deposit money into my savings or checking account. And at the average bank, you get very little for that, like almost nothing in interest, sometimes like a tiny percentage of a, you know, like a tiny, tiny percentage of a point, unless you're at like a high yield savings bank, which I want to talk about later. But the average bank, you don't make a lot of interest on the money you keep in your savings or checking accounts. Now, they then take that money that you're holding with them and they invest it often in treasury bonds, right? Or in like the bond market. And they're making money off of that yield. So they pay you very little for your money to sit in their bank in terms of like interest to you. But they might be making 5 to 6% on those bonds. And that 5 to 6% margin is what they're making. That's how that bank profits, right? But they also need your money to stay in their bank long enough to actually hold that bond and get that interest rate. If all of a sudden you start withdrawing all your money, they've got to sell those bonds early at a loss and they can become insolvent, right? And that's what happened here with SVB, right?
Yeah. So in the case of SVB, they were heavily invested in U.S. bonds. And bonds are also like a loan. So, I mean, it is a loan by some other entity that the bank is purchasing and they get a return from the person who's borrowing the money. In the same way that doing a loan to a startup in Silicon Valley, they would provide some interest rate and repay that over time. They could also do things like investing stakes in new businesses. They could be buying real estate. They could be doing a million different things. The point is that regardless of what the bank is doing with your money, they have given it away and hope to get a return in excess of what they are paying their customers for. And the interesting thing about SVP is that it happened so rapidly, in no small part due to social media, that I think it caught everyone by surprise and in kind of a shocking way. There was a Wall Street Journal opinion piece where the title was the SVB collapse a Twitter panic? And the subhead, the madness of crowds is becoming everyday life in the 21st century.
Well, and to your point, they had a run on deposits. So yeah. Word got out, and to your point, via social and probably Twitter, didn't know which one, but yes, that they actually did. They knew they were having some issues and they
announced that they were going to raise more capital to cover this shortfall. And that freaked everybody out.
Yeah. And people saw through that and started looking at their balance sheet and realized that it was a lot of bad debt. And it freaked everyone out. There was a run on deposits. And all of a sudden, that formula of how a bank stays solvent, which is there's more deposits than withdrawals, went upside down. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, everyone's trying to withdraw all their money, which forces them to sell bonds at a loss. And again, yes, in this case, it was bonds, but it could be whatever they choose to invest that in. But the bond market used to be a really safe investment. It hasn't been doing so well recently. And they didn't have enough capital or liquidity on their balance sheet to meet all of those withdrawals. And they just overnight, with that run on deposits, basically went upside down.
And Maggie, you made the point earlier about if the bank could hold on to those bonds until maturity, they would have cash to cover normal withdrawals or even increase withdrawals. But the withdrawal requests were so large that they had to start selling stuff at a loss. And it just spiraled out of control once people started to freak out. And this is kind of similar to the Great Depression, which I don't remember because I was not born. But, you know, there was a lot of bank runs. That's kind of where the term came from.
And the bonds are interesting because we'll come back to this when we talk about what the government's doing to help these now, not just one failing bank, but multiple failing banks, because it is relevant that they were heavily invested in bonds. When we get to that part, we'll talk about it. I know, big teaser. You're like, wow,
just wait
I can't
for
wait
our
to hear
hot
about
bond topic.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the reasons I think this has been so traumatic or shocking for people is because it brings back a lot of memories of 2008 where banks collapsed and it led to a prolonged recession, which was hugely impactful. I'm curious, Maggie, what do you remember of 2008 and how you felt?
I don't remember a lot from 2008, honestly. First off, I have a bad memory. But then more importantly, I would, you know, in 2008, I was 6 years out of college. I was not invested in the market at all, because for those of you who remember, I didn't invest until I was in like my mid-30s for a bunch of reasons. And so I wasn't concerned about like the drop in the market that was happening. We had sold our house in 2007. And so I and bought the house that I actually live in now in 2007. And so I remember, one thing I do remember about 2008 is being like, whew, that was a good time to like, we didn't like make a huge profit on our house, but we would have definitely taken a loss if we had, you know, been trying to sell it in 2008. And so I did feel like I dodged a small bullet there, but I just didn't have, I don't know, I don't remember like a lot of specific feelings of it really like impacting me personally at the time. What were you feeling in 2008?
I was in business school and did not have a lot of money in the stock market. I do remember, though, the impact to the labor market and...
Yeah, jobs.
You know, I think you were employed and you stayed employed. Were there layoffs at your company at the time?
I think there must have been, but I worked in the e-commerce area that was still a heavily growing part of our business. And so I do believe there were layoffs now that I think about it. But again, I was like young. I just don't remember being heavily like aware of or impacted. I probably was aware. I mean, I know I was aware of it, to be clear. Like I was not an idiot in 2008, but it just wasn't like a huge, you know, in the way that I would have been aware of it now and kind of following it a little bit more closely.
Yeah. So I was looking for internships in between my 2 years of business school. And I remember I was about to get an offer from Citigroup, big bank. And the recruiter called me and she's like, I'm really sorry. Our program has been canceled and I've been let go. And I'm like, oh shit. And so this was happening to all my peers. Like it was really tough to go get jobs out of business school. And I remember discussing it at length in every single class that we took, because it touched every element of business. It was so massive and so prolonged that I can see why people are freaked out at just the mention of bank run or bank collapse.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I was also in business school in 2008 in an evening program at Emory. And I think I just... don't remember that time. I'm going to go back to that because I'm sure we were talking about it a lot. But hey, SVB, which by the way, just for a fun fact, it was the 16th largest bank. Are you still the 16th largest bank after you failed?
That's a good question. Are you a bank at all?
Do you always get to claim that? But anyways, I don't mean to make light of it, but it was the 16th largest bank in the US and it was the largest bank failure since 2008. So that's why this matters, of like something this big in this realm has not happened since 2008.
And the interesting thing that I think is adding to the panic is that this is a direct result of what's happening with inflation and rising interest rates from the Fed. Now, this isn't to say that the bank didn't make some mistakes. Clearly, their investment strategy was not as sound as it could have been. They were not protecting themselves against risk like other banks. And this is not isolated right now, which is making the situation worse. So Signature...
And more like 2008, right, which more like was like a domino now, of like, oh, you hear one thing, then there's something.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you're like, whoa, shit, this is pretty bad.
Now, Signature Bank has also failed and the FDIC is taking that over. They had a little too much exposure to crypto, and I think they're being investigated by the Justice Department, so it's probably some other issues that caused it. But a lot of it still stems from rising interest rates and then concern about the economy. And we are also seeing this like globally. So Credit Suisse in Switzerland, their stock price tanked like 30% in a day over concerns, and they're going to get a bailout from the Swiss government. I've been watching some of the other bank stocks, some of whom have no issues reported yet, but like Charles Schwab was down, you know, 30 or 40% over the course of a couple of days. Other smaller banks are down, you know, 75%. People are like very concerned about it.
One bank down 60%. Yeah, some pretty like massive drops. But hey, Mike, what I think you're about to say is, you know, when we were just why this is happening and why this could be happening more broadly, when we were talking about how banks make money around loans and investments, you've got tough market conditions on both ends of how they make money, right? On loans, interest rates are up, so fewer people are getting mortgages. So mortgages are down. So they're getting fewer loans than they normally get. They're making less money off of loans than they used to. And then on the flip side, on the investments piece, which is, again, when you put money into a bank, they're actually taking that money and investing it and making money off of it. Because of inflation, people are putting less money into banks and they're taking more money out. If they had money in banks, like the savings withdrawal rate is like really high right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's just, or the rate of savings is actually another way to say it. The rate of savings is really low. So people are saving less, putting less in banks, taking more out of banks, which is impacting another arm of how banks are making money. And again, to your point on SVB, depending on, you know, how solid their strategy is and how risky some of their investments are, these two factors can really put a lot of pressure on a bank's liquidity, right? And just it can make them insolvent, which is what's happened with SVB and Signature.
And so I think there is a risk that this could become what's called a contagion in finance terms, where like whatever is causing this spreads to everybody. One of the reasons I don't think that's going to happen is that, like, let's take SVP.
I don't know why I keep sounding like you're saying SVP.
I think I am sort of saying it. SVB.
Oh, okay. VB.
Thank you. And
either way, yeah. Whatever you want to call it.
So there was this bank run and people were withdrawing tens of billions of dollars, but they're not keeping that under their mattress, right? It's going to other banks because it has to be held somewhere. It's not like gold bars that you go into a vault and take out. And so there's been other analyses that showed that some banks have benefited tremendously from this collapse. You know, I think what happened in 2008, everyone was involved in the same sort of problem with these mortgage-backed security derivatives and the collapse of the housing market. But this one, you know, SVB made some bad decisions with bonds. Signature made some bad decisions with crypto. Yes, there's higher interest rates, so the banking sector is a little bit more vulnerable. And yes, there's some global economic pressure. But I don't think this is something that's going to spread to all banks like we saw in 2008.
Well, Mike, is it true that what would make it a contagion is if everybody freaks out and starts withdrawing all of their money from banks? Because that doesn't help.
Well, yes, but to my earlier point, they have to withdraw it and put it somewhere, right? So if every bank had a bank run and the people demanded cash that they were going to go keep in their basement, yes, all banks would collapse. But, you know, I was reading that Bank of America had some huge influx of like $10 billion of deposits from this.
Okay, so they're just, when you're
they're just moving in.
Yeah, when you don't trust one bank and you decide to go to another bank.
Right.
So let's talk about what I care about, Mike.
what do you care about these days, Maggie?
Wealthfront.
Okay.
And I know I'm using Wealthfront as an example, but I want to talk about high yield savings accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, or high yield, I mean, there's some banks that sort of specialize in high yield savings accounts, right? Ally, Wealthfront. Citi is well known for having a good high yield one. Capital One, a couple of big banks also, but some kind of more niche banks too. And they pay out, like, using those examples of, you know, how they invest our money, when they're paying out, you know, high threes, 4% right now, their margin and yield is much smaller, right? Like the profit they're able to take off that money is much smaller than what an SVP was able to take when they're paying out, you know, a tiny piddly like percentage of a percentage point.
That's an interesting thought. I think it is a little more complicated than that because we don't know what the underlying investments are that those banks have and where they are securing their capital from and at what rate.
But that's kind of a theme. I don't know.
Yeah.
Nobody, every single bank is different.
Yeah.
I don't know. How would I know and trust that my money is safe at Wealthfront? That's the question I think most people have. And fill in Wealthfront, fill in the blank with wherever you keep your money, Bank of America, Wealthfront.
Yeah.
You know, whoever.
I think the larger the institution, generally speaking, the safer it's going to be. You know, I was reading something about Charles Schwab, because Schwab made some public announcement that caused their stock price to drop like 30%. But it really wasn't anything having to do with their underlying business. And their business was something like, I think they had something like $7 trillion of customer deposits versus an SVB, which was $175 billion. I should really Google this before I start giving some stats here. Yeah, so, oh, that was pretty close. $7.38 trillion in total client assets.
At Schwab.
At Schwab, which I like and I use personally. So I think the larger the companies that you are investing with, generally speaking, the safer they're going to be. Also, the larger companies, as a result of 2008, have different liquidity requirements than smaller institutions. So they need to be a little bit safer in their structure than other groups. And so Wealthfront, I don't know a lot about, but I believe that they actually partner with multiple banks, not just one. And so you would spread the risk of one of them collapsing.
So Wealthfront actually sent out a note to their customers this week. And I'll just read it because it's interesting and it kind of provides some context and it'll segue us into talking about FDIC insurance, which is part of the answer to like, should I feel good about where my money is? And real quick on SVB, the problem is SVB was FDIC insured up to $250,000, but they had a lot of high net worth individuals and companies that had way more than $250,000 in there. But the government stepped in to kind of provide more than just $250,000. But I don't have more in Wealthfront than what is insured by FDIC insurance, which, by the way, Wealthfront provides $2 million worth of FDIC insurance when many banks provide $250,000 or maybe $500,000. But anyways, here's Wealthfront's note. We want to let you know that Wealthfront did not have any client deposits with Silicon Valley Bank or Signature Bank. I like how they right away like are like, we don't work with these two guys. Like, these two banks are not in our cash sweep program, and your deposits are safe and secure in our FDIC-insured partner banks. If you would like to see a complete list of banks we work with, we publish that information here. And it's like a long list. So to your point, it's diversified, which I think is a good thing. Our cash account is designed to maximize the safety of your deposits in difficult macroeconomic environments. We work with over a dozen FDIC-insured banks who all undergo an initial risk assessment to be considered for the program, as well as regular quarterly risk reviews to remain in the program. We assess if the bank is well capitalized, among many other factors, which was a big issue with SVB specifically. I don't know about Signature, but because we work with multiple banks, Wealthfront clients currently receive a 4.05 APY and up to $2 million in FDIC insurance. When we add more banks to our program, we're able to evaluate increasing the FDIC insurance we offer. We're in the process of doing this now, and we hope to have an update to share with you soon. Your money is secure in our cash account. It may give you even more peace of mind to know that Sheila Bair, the chair of the FDIC from 2006 to 2011, is a member of our advisory board. So that's like halfway kind of PR, making you feel better. But all these banks are trying to stop people freaking out and pulling out all their money for business reasons of that's how they make money. But also because, again, with what happened to SVB, it was related to there's a concern that there's this like contagion, right? Of like everybody's going to start freaking out and withdrawing all their money, and it can cause, you know, a lot more issues if that actually happens.
It's interesting to hear you read that from Wealthfront, because the way that works technically is that the FDIC limit is $250,000 per depositor per account. And so by spreading these across multiple accounts, and I think this means that each deposit is technically in eight separate institutions. So $2 million, you spread that risk and you spread your protection.
They actually have more than eight, but
no, but I mean like each deposit would have at least eight accounts that would give you.
You mean if you had 2 million?
So, yeah.
Yeah. If you had 2 million, yes.
250,000 times eight would be $2 million of your protection.
Yeah. And the average person doesn't have $2 million in their account anyways, but yes, they've actually created a system that I think is pretty intelligent to spread that risk. And also from a consumer point of view, make them feel good, you know, that they've got a higher level of FDIC insurance than the average bank provides.
So if you are not with Wealthfront and you have all of your money sitting in one account with one institution, if you're worried about it, you could open up multiple accounts. You could put your money in different accounts across different institutions so that you are FDIC protected for your total amount, not just for what's in your one account. So there are ways to take advantage of this if you're concerned about it. So Maggie, how concerned are you about the future of the global economy right now?
I mean, we talked about this on, do you remember we did, I'm going to find the episode real quick, Mike. We talked about this recently on an episode, and let me pull up the episode number real quick just for reference, because I feel similarly now. That's a tough word to say. I feel similar now.
Same with SVB.
B. It's, right.
We have a lot of tongue twisters.
You want to say SVP like a senior vice president. So, our very first episode, in episode 33, we did Mike Explains the Economy, which was a fun episode. When I was trying to find our recent one, that one came up. So, Mike, at the end of 2022, I found it. It's episode 180. We did an episode where we read an article called Raising the Alarm on the U.S. Economy.
Oh, yeah, right? The article episode, yeah.
Yeah, and we talked about our feelings in that episode. And the reason I'm referencing that is because I'm not sure my feelings have changed significantly, right? Like, there are a lot of things that could be pulling us into the recession. There's a number of kind of macroeconomic factors happening at play, and we've talked about some of them around, you know, inflation, interest rates, et cetera. But ultimately, like, it doesn't change my view on things that we talked about in that episode, which is I am mentally, during a time like this, I like to kind of plan for the worst, but hope for the best. That's just always been my mentality.
And so emotionally, you've been preparing for this for decades, Maggie.
My whole life. Yeah. Honestly, we've talked about like my late entry into the investing world and some of the things that kind of didn't have me investing when I was younger. A lot of it was fear, right? And it was saying like, look, I'd rather just keep the money I have, right? I'm not looking to make a big increase and return on investment on my money. I just want to keep the money I work so hard to earn, right? And so I was kind of late to the game as a result of that. And it was a lot of fear-based things, right? And so I do still have that fear kind of, I've gotten a lot better about it. And I've become more, sort of optimistic for the future in many ways. But there are a lot of things happening that can be a little scary right now. And my just general approach, again, during these scarier times financially and in the economy, is it's a good time to like tighten your belt and to, you know, there's more risk of losing your job. Like you were talking about in 2008, Mike, right? There could be more risk to losing your job. That's not a new thing. That's been kind of going on for the last year, depending on what industry you work in. And I think people should always be prepared for something tough financially to happen. And it's kind of how I've lived my life. And again, I'm not encouraging people to live their life from a place of fear, but I think you can, you know, reframe that to say like, you should be prepared for the worst. You should have a strong emergency fund. You should know what you would do tomorrow if you lost your job. You should understand where your money is and how it's invested and feel pretty good about it, right? You shouldn't be freaking out and pulling all your, you know, I'm getting a really nice, I'm getting 4.35% from Wealthfront right now. It's 4.05, but with their referral program right now, if you come in through a referral or you give a referral, you get an extra, actually you get an extra 0.5%. Sorry. So I'm getting 4.55% right now. That's really high on cash, which I'm holding on to because I don't have a job, right? And I need some liquidity in my life right now. And I don't want to keep pulling money out of the market. To me, that kind of summarizes how I'm thinking about things right now. And again, it's, I don't know if cautiously optimistic is even the right term. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling cautiously optimistic, but for different reasons. You know, we've had such sustained high growth for so long that stuff has to correct. That's how markets work. And so we've seen this in the tech industry. All of the high-flying tech stocks have come crashing down 50, 60%. They're all laying off tens of thousands of workers. Like they're going through a correction. I think we're going to start to see some banks correct and some of the financial controls come into play. I also sort of like is the wrong word. I appreciate these opportunities when panic sets in because panic is a good time to make investment decisions. Now, just to be clear, when something drops 50%, it doesn't mean it's going to go back up. It could be dropping because the business is crumbling and it's a terrible investment, but it could be panic driven and it could be a great buying opportunity. Like if you had invested at the bottom of the 2008 recession, you would have made a killing coming back. Now, people who just stayed in made their money back and then some, but if you time these things well, you can do quite considerable returns. And so I'm not changing my overall investment strategy. Being well diversified and spreading your funds out across multiple institutions is certainly the right way to go. But I also am optimistic that a lot of these things are panic-driven drops that will rebound. And I've taken advantage of them. And I've made some purchases of bank stocks recently, not a ton of money, a meaningful amount, but not a ton. And I think we're just going to have this kind of rolling series of corrections that hit different types of industries and different severities, and we'll eventually pull through and things will recover.
Yeah. I mean, I think your general stance of remaining calm and collected under pressure and in crisis is a good approach for everyone in many situations, right? The people who remain calm and collected, and it doesn't mean you like do your research, understand what's happening, but do it in a calm and thoughtful way, is a much better approach than like freaking out and being like, I'm going to pull all my money out of the market. I'm going to pull all my, you know,
doing your own bank run. Maybe not the best.
Yes. Not. Yeah. Keep it. I'm going to keep all my money under my mattress. Like I knew I should have been doing that from the beginning. Right. It's not necessarily helpful. I mean, we should probably give that disclaimer now on we're sharing our opinions. This is not financial advice. You need to do what makes sense for you. We don't know your personal situation. Is that the disclaimer?
Yeah, that's right. I did not make any specific stock recommendations, though. I personally think that some of these banks, not all of them, some of them are just caught up in panic selling and will rebound quite quickly.
Yeah. And to be clear, Mike and I personally, we are not pulling any of our money out of savings accounts, checking accounts.
Yeah, I didn't cash out my 529 to go invest in SVB Bank hoping it rebounds.
Yeah, yes. So another topic that I think is helpful for people, Mike, is what is the government doing to help right now these two failing banks? And what could potentially be more?
Well, they have a couple steps. The first one is that they insure individual accounts up to 250, and then they will take over a bank. And that's what happened on Monday the 13th. SVB was reopened as a FDIC-controlled bank. Same with Signature. For everybody over that 250, they are receiving what's called receiver's certificates, which means that they kind of get in line with creditors. And in the discussion right now is like, is this a bailout? Do they deserve it? I'm not clear on what exactly the government is going to do on a bank bailout perspective. It is in the government's interest, because it's in the national interest, to stop what could be a contagion and make sure people feel confident in the banking system. So it wouldn't surprise me if they just sort of sweep this one under the rug and take care of it themselves.
Well, my understanding also, in addition to the FDIC stepping in, is that the federal government is basically coming in. So all those failing bonds we talked about where, you know, SVB was having to basically sell those bonds at a loss. They're making them whole by saying, we'll actually give you the bonds at, you know, if you were expecting to get $100 from it, we will give you that $100, right? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Fed, and apparently, because there's been a lot of like quotes and stuff in the news about this, of Biden saying like they're stepping in to help, but no losses will be borne by the taxpayers, right? That was a quote from Biden. And the explanation of how they're able to step in and buy those failing bonds at a better rate to make them whole, the federal government will still get their money over time. They're kind of in a way, I don't know if loaning is the right word, but they're fronting some money that they will eventually make good because those bonds are also invested. The government essentially has those bonds invested, if that makes sense.
That's interesting. And that makes sense. I guess I'm glad to see it.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically the government stepping in to create some liquidity and a cash flow solution, but it's a Band-Aid. It's just a Band-Aid for some banks. It doesn't help them long-term. And I think long-term, my understanding is there's going to be similar to 2008 and how after all that happened, there was a significantly higher amount of regulation that came into the mortgage industry to the point where like now if you get a mortgage, like it's really hard for me to get a mortgage now. I don't have a job, right? I could show money in the bank, but I don't have a job. And there's just there's a lot more hoops you've got to jump through now because of all the regulations if you do want to get a mortgage. But there, the government is coming in and will be putting more regulation on banks to make sure that they can meet their cash flow. But all that additional regulation over time also means less profitability for banks moving forward. So I would imagine we'll see, you know, smaller banks, I don't know if collapsing is the right word, but getting bought up by bigger banks. I don't know, just a guessing, a prediction.
So I guess to summarize, we recommend that people stay calm and carry on.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we, and understand what's happening because it's important to understand it so you can stay calm, right? It's not helpful to just be like, oh, don't worry about it. This doesn't really, you know, this shouldn't impact you day to day. It is a thing happening in the economy, and it's not a positive thing happening in the economy, right? And so, you know, when we look at all of these broader things happening around us, yeah, it's normal to feel a little bit more nervous about your financial situation, but it's less tied to your money in the bank and more tied to, you know, things like this have a higher chance of like pushing us into a recession, mm-hmm. right? Is that true, Mike?
Yeah, I think any weakening of any sector helps contribute.
That was one
to
of
it.
Those statements with the like affect the end where I'm like, it's actually more of a question, but yeah. And so again, if people want to worry about something, again, I'm not trying to make people worry about something, but if you want to worry about something, don't worry about the banking system. Just worry about like your job security and whether you have an emergency fund. And the good thing about that is it's the stuff you can control in your day-to-day life, right? Like you can't control what happens to SVB Bank, right? You can control certain things. Like I like Wealthfront even more now that I didn't understand this before, but this is not an ad for Wealthfront, by the way. I don't make any money. I've already maxed out my referrals for my higher interest rate. So I'm not trying to like, you know, get anything from anyone. I like Wealthfront. And I like them even more knowing how diversified they are. And I already knew about the higher FDIC insurance. I just didn't realize it was because of their diversification that they were able to kind of times that by 8, basically. I'm using Wealthfront as an example of like, you know, understand where you do have your money. Feel good that you're doing as much diligence as you can. And, you know, carry on with the stuff you can control. Don't worry about the stuff you can't control.
So we will air part two of our career episode next week, unless there is some other catastrophe in the global economy, in which case we will jump in with some other timely thoughts. But I hope this was interesting and helpful.
Yeah. I don't know that we need top three takeaways.
I don't think we do.
We've kind of set them.
But I think we should give our normal close, and I will kick it off. Thanks for listening. If you've been challenged or inspired by what you've heard, please share this episode with a friend or family member. We believe that talking to friends about money improves and deepens your relationships, and it's why we started this podcast. So spread the word and share this with a friend.
You can also rate and review the show and subscribe to make sure that you never miss an episode. If you have any thoughts or questions, we would love to hear from you. And you can leave us a voicemail or text us at 404-981-3370 or hit us up on Instagram. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Maggie. Bye.
Okay, bye.